Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Join us on Monday evenings, U.S. Eastern Time, as we explore homeopathy and facial analysis, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks and Grant Bentley, homeopath and naturopath. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brooks, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is February 13, 2012, here in America, and perhaps it is already the 14th Valentine's Day in Australia, and I hope you're going to have a fun celebration. I don't know if it's a holiday that you celebrate over there, but I think it seems to be spreading around the globe.
Yeah, hi, Debbie. It is, it's the 14th already here, so it's a very happy Valentine's Day to Louise from me. And so, yeah, no, it's not a public holiday or anything. It's just something where we, you know, it's the traditional flowers or a box of chocolates or going out to dinner, but no, not a public holiday as such.
It sounds lovely. I'm glad that you sent a greeting over to Louise. So we are getting started in our quick 30-minute session and continuing on learning about the facial analysis and how you use this incredible tool that you have been discovered and it has been evolving to learn more and more about it as you continue to figure out which remedies go to each one of the miasms in the groups. And I want to just ask those folks who are out there listening, please share these shows with other people. Get on Twitter and send a tweet, send a message in your email, on your Facebook, just push that share button, and let other people know that we have this incredible resource right here to learn more about homeopathy and facial analysis. So I won't spend any more time on that, and let's just keep learning.
Well, last time, Debbie, we were talking a little bit about just observing and being, I guess, an unprejudiced observer and what that actually means. And more importantly, I guess, for the homeopath, it's beginning to spot trends and patterns in the observation that we're seeing. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to impose our opinions on that, nor do we have to actually turn around and start to interpret what it is that the person is saying. That's the whole thing behind Hahnemann's Unprejudiced Observer, is to, I guess, rather than to take a case and decipher a case, it's to accept a case rather than anything else. So we're looking, though, at trying to see patterns within the case, because We when it came to the generals, we understand that according to the rules that have been set down by Herring and Kent has reiterated and so on, that we're talking about the three particulars essentially become a general. Now, what we mean by this, and this was Herring that spoke about this, that you... He spoke about there's if you've got a chair or a stool, you need at least three legs for that stool to be balanced before you sit on it. So we're looking for approximately, you know, theoretically at least, we are looking for that stability via frequency running throughout the particulars of a case to make up the generals of the case. Now, the same thing occurs when we're looking at the mental. So what I thought that I'd do is that I'd just explain a little bit, because I've been lucky enough to travel around the world with homeopathy, and one of the things that I realise is that people's understanding of how to repertorize, what is a general, what is a mental, and so on, can vary greatly. Like most homeopaths, because it's cottage industry in the Western world, I was fairly well acquainted with what I believed was my interpretation of a general and my interpretation of a mental. But then when you go and speak to other people, you realize that they can have an entirely different interpretation. And quite often, after I've done lectures, it's not just the facial analysis that people are interested in. In fact, a lot of people at the end of it will, during the breaks or during the lunchtimes, will come up to me and say, you know, I need to understand how you selected that particular rubric, or why did you choose that particular rubric. And so one of the things that I have always taught my students throughout the year, and I really do stick by this, is that if you can't repertorize, you can't practice. I'm just simply not a fan of the... I'm not a fan of this idea that I don't need to repertorize because I'm good enough to be able to tell what my patients are. The remedies themselves have thousands upon thousands upon thousands, if you're talking about a polycrest, of single individual rubrics, and we can't possibly memorize all of them. Hahnemann certainly couldn't memorize them. This is why he developed his own repertory. And I think that we as a profession are really indebted to the person who read Hahnemann's repertory and thought to himself, oh, there's got to be a better way of doing it than this. And this is Bonninghausen. Now, Bonninghausen was the one really that we owe a lot to. I think people like Kent and Hahnemann quite, logically, gets most of the credit. And you can tell why. I mean, he did most of the system. But, other people like Kent and so are really up there in the biggies of homeopathic history. And I sometimes think that Bonninghausen doesn't get quite the regard that he really should, because what he did is that he applied a non-medical but very logical mind to trying to understand how a layperson can utilize and use homeopathy. And the way that he did this ended up being his therapeutic pocketbook. And so if we understand what is in Bonninghausen's mind and how he is trying to in a true lawyer's style, because that's what Bonninghausen was. He was a trained lawyer, not a doctor. And so what we find is that in Bonninghausen's development of the therapeutic pocketbook, we see the lawyer's mind of let's sort out fact from fiction here and let's generalize what is occurring rather than focusing on absolutely every individual specific. Kent later on, of course, came in and criticised quite severely in his mind Bonninghausen. Mind you, Kent was very good at criticising. He had a bit of a reputation for that. But he criticised Bonninghausen and, of course, Kent's repertory, which has become extremely famous, and I'm not trying to run down Kent's work at all, but it is different. It's a different way of viewing it than Bonninghausen, because what Kent did is that Kent looked at Bonninghausen's repertory and said, well, look, there's hardly any mentals for a start. And also, too, the whole idea that a general can represent absolutely every specific feature in a disease is nonsense. What I mean by that is that, yes, okay, we might have a general amelioration by heat in arsenicum, but the headache of arsenicum is actually ameliorated by cold and not by heat. So you can't generalize it to that degree. So as a result, what Kent did is that he went into such idiosyncratic specifics that we had a smallish book in the therapeutic pocketbook to a huge book in Kent's repertory. Now, I think that I think there that maybe Bonninghausen has been a little maligned there, because the logic was this, that if we can understand the generals of the case, the specifics will generally be tied into that. And also, too, when it came to the mentals, Bonninghausen specifically did not put numerous mentals in because of the reason that he understood that language changed, and also, too, that personal expression and linguistics vary from one region to another, let alone one country, and over time. Now, there's a very good example of this. I quote this in the course that we do, the larger, longer 15-week course. There's a rubric for Calc Fleur, as if there is a cornstalk fiddle playing in the head. So what you do is you go to Kent's repertory, and then you put in the noises, and then you've got to go to cornstalk, and then, you know, as if playing in the head. Now, in Bonninghausen's mind, the chances of somebody coming in, he's not saying that that doesn't exist. What Bonninghausen is saying when he writes his book is that the chances of somebody coming in and saying that word perfectly is very, very slim. So what you're better off having is just a section, a rubric section of noises in the head, rather than trying to be as specific as the cornstalk fiddle playing in the head. And so I guess being a bit of a fan and rediscovering Bonninghausen, as we always do when we go through our training, we do Bonninghausen and then we do Kent, or hopefully we do that, and we end up with a really good grounding. So what we have now is that I just want to talk about it from the generals, from a Bonninghausen perspective, because I have found in my clinic that this is a much easier way of doing it than trying to be idiosyncratic and extremely specific and targeting like Kent is trying to do. Now, I understand that Materia Medica and the general contemporary way of practicing homeopathy has gone down that post-Kentian line. But for me, what works is the Bonninghausen method. Now, where we were talking earlier about Herring, and he was saying that in order for a chair or at least a stool to have balance before you sit on it, you want to have three legs to it, otherwise it's a bit imbalanced. And it's that same analogy that he brings forward to a general. But, of course, he's looking more at physical generals. But what he means is this, is when we look at the generals, we'll see somebody talking about a headache. We question them about their headache and they tell us that it's worse on the left side. We also learn later that the person had problems with their spleen and that their arthritis mainly affects them in their left left knee. So what we can see there with all three of those particulars is that each one of those particulars is left-sided. So now what we do is, rather than put in the headache and we put in the ailments in the spleen and we put in the arthritis in the left knee, like Kent is telling us to do, I'm just going to ignore Kent just a little and go back to Bonninghausen and say, well, look, really what we're looking at, we're trying to see themes rather than the specifics. I understand that perhaps arsenicum doesn't have better for warmth when it comes to the headache, but let's play the odds. Let's play the fact that the majority of the complaints are restless and better for warmth and so on. So what I like to do is exactly what Bonninghausen says, and that is play the odds. So I would put in, because I can see a general theme running through of left-sidedness, then I'm going to go to the generals and I'm going to put in side, left, drop and drag into the box. notice that I'm not going and putting through the three different areas. I'm going to the generals and bringing it across. Now, the same can be said for people. Let's go a little bit further here, because what we've got to do, what the simillimum shows us, because we're meant to be experts in understanding the simillimum. Understanding the simillimum means that we cannot be literal with anything in life, and specifically, we cannot be literal with homeopathy. Isopathy is literal. Simillimum is not literal. It's more lateral than that. So we've got to apply that same logic to everything. So when we are looking at a case, for example, and the person says, well, look, you know, I generally do a checklist. And this checklist includes whether or not the person has hay fever, if there's skin problems, dermatitis, whether or not they have food allergies and so on. So let's just pretend in this instance that our patient is coming to us for multiple allergies. So they are coming to see us because they have bad hay fever. They are also coming to see us because they can't pet dogs or cats or anything because that will give them a contact dermatitis. And then through the course of questioning, we also realize that they are slightly allergic to milk products. It makes them quite catarrhal and mucousy, but also too that they can't eat meat because that will make, you know, it'll give them a headache, or it could be coffee, it could be anything like this. Now, that doesn't exclude the fact that we can't use any of these if they are dramatic. So that has to be on a scale of drama that it causes in the body. But in all of this that we're talking about, we do in fact have a few generals, and it's the generals that we're looking for. And the general that we have in this patient sitting in front of us is a general sensitivity. So I will go to the generals, the general section, and I will put in the sensitiveness and drop and drag. Because what we're seeing in this patient is their overreaction to a number of different complaints. The pollens in the air, the pet hair or dander that they can't touch, the different food products or perhaps chemicals. So that is a generalized sensitivity that the patient is expressing. So this is why I'm saying that, you know, bringing in this unprejudiced observer. We've got to observe in its totality, because everything comes back to simillimum and totality and the law of dominance. And if we understand those and apply those laterally, like the simillimum experts we are, then we can begin to see those trends. So I kind of guess, in a way, I am bucking the contemporary system of going into smaller and smaller and smaller rubrics. And I am certainly bucking the trend of the single, specific, non-interchangeable remedy that many lecturers are saying that we need to aim for. And this comes from Kenton himself as well. But the simillimum tells us that while there will, you can't just go into your pharmacy and pick any remedy off the shelf. What I find interesting, we were talking last week about skeptics, and that skeptics poll ends up being rigged, just like I was saying. The skeptics, I mean, this is just, you know, this is a big deal in Australia at the moment, and one of the things that I find most interesting is that while the skeptics accuse us as being charlatans and liars, what ends up always being uncovered is that they are the biggest liars of the lot. And this last poll kind of proves that, but that's a different topic. But you can't just go into your pharmacy and pick any remedy off the shelf. You can't just sort of say, oh, well, I can't decide whether it's ant heart or whether or not it's tuberculinum and just give it. I mean, the two are so different from one another. So when I say that I'm not a fan of the specific remedy where there is no interchangeableness with other remedies, what I'm saying is that providing that the remedy that you choose mimics or is a close similimum to the patient who's sitting in front of you, then yes, it's true that a rare and exotic remedy may do wonders for that person. But if that miasm of the patient if the miasm of the patient and the repertorization showing that the similimum totality also matches, then I can assure you that calcarb will do just as good a job as whatever rare and exotic remedy is being put up as being the similimum. So there is not one similimum. There can't be, because otherwise we're getting into exacts, we're getting into isopathy, and for those that don't understand isopathy or what Hahnemann thought about it, he said that it was nonsense. Okay, so whenever you hear somebody saying that this is the similimum and there is no other similimum, you know immediately from a Hahnemannian perspective that that's got to be wrong. So there are a number of similimums that this person can have, but there is not an open slather. It has to be well repertorized. It still has to fit the dynamic nature of the illness they're suffering from and the underlying miasm. And why I brought up the skeptics, I suppose, is because I find it interesting that the skeptics will talk about that every success we have is placebo, but I find it very interesting that we have as many failures often as every health practitioner does, but I don't understand why the placebo doesn't count there. But let's get back more to the main topic rather than having a little bitch about the skeptics. The topic is the observer. Now, so what we've seen is that we are relatively well trained in observing generals when it comes to sides or when it comes to, you know, other things that are more obvious. But we've got to begin to extend that out, and we see that in a person who is multi-allergic, we don't just necessarily do aggravation from coffee, aggravation in autumn, aggravation, and end up with about 8 aggravations that they have told us literally. What we do there is we put in the one rubric of the general sensitivity. The same can also occur in foods. So if we're talking about foods, for example, if someone says, well, look, I can't do coffee very well and I can't do sweets very well and I can't do alcohol, I've got to stay away from that, and I've also got to stay away from spicy foods as well. Now, we can do the more Kentian approach and be specific and drag and drop, or we can look at what do all these things have in common. That's a more Bonninghausen approach. And for me, I found that it works much better. So what I'd be looking for is that I'd be looking for stimulating foods, because that's what all of those foods just mentioned have in common. This is a worse for stimulants. Or perhaps just sticking with the food. If somebody is talking about, look, the tomatoes make my knees play up, and, you know, anything with lemon or orange juice or lime, as much as I love it, but it'll give me a headache, and I can't eat beetroot or anything. You know, so when we go into these things, again, it's not having a look at and dropping and dragging every specific food stuff. It's what do all these foods have in common, and generalize it into the one rubric. Because in this particular case, what I'll do now is that I'll go into sour or acidic foods, drag and drop, one rubric. So at the end of it, what I have is a repertorization by doing it in this model. I have a repertorization that I may only have 6 or 7 rubrics, but when you generalize, how encompassing those general rubrics become. They tell, in just a few words, a complete story. Whereas if I'm going to rewrite that person's biography, it could take me all day. When I was in India, people were coming up to me saying, when I was showing my repertorization, and they were saying to me, how long does it take you to repertorize? And I think I can remember Louise was talking to somebody, and Louise answered, well, look, generally it'll probably take us anywhere between 3, 5, sometimes 6 or 7 minutes. And I mean, just this one person that I'm thinking of, was their jaw just hit the floor because they said it can take them up to 40 minutes to repertorize a case. Repertorization is really easy if you use this method. This is the method Bonninghausen knew Hahnemann better than any other person. When it came to homeopathy, he knew exactly what Hahnemann was trying to get across, sometimes in terms that are far more understandable than Hahnemann could express himself. And I think there is no better area that expresses this than in the Bonninghausen approach to repertorizing a case and his therapeutic pocketbook. We can also see this in mental symptoms as well. So I guess what I do is that I don't try and specifically identify the core nature of the person, but what I do is that I try and generalize what mental complaints or what stressful obstacles may have caused this patient's energy to be run down or stressed to a point where pathology results. So what I do is that it's not so much a tell me who you are, tell me about yourself, tell me what that feels like. That's kind of, for me, I've been on that endless merry-go-round and it doesn't get me anywhere. What I do is that I say, okay, what I want to do now is that I want to go through the stresses that have occurred in your life. And the best way for me to do this is to understand your biography. Now, you know, in the past I was taught, look, when somebody is crying or when somebody doesn't want to talk about something, that's when you go into the kill, because they're trying to hold you back. This is where the sore spot really is. But now I just say to every patient, if there's anything you don't want to talk about, just tell me and I'll stop. And the reason for this is because now I know how to generalize life themes, generalize people's biography. I don't need to put them through the pain. So what I do is that I'll say to them, look, tell me about your childhood home. They tell me about the dynamics there. What I'm looking for is any sort of conflict, any sort of stress. Then what I do then is I just make a note of that stress, should it be there. Let's just say, for example, this is a patient whose house was argumentative and they hate it. They used to hide in their room. Later on, what we see is that they did okay in primary school, but in high school there was a bit of bullying and they were picked on a little bit and they got a bit sick during that time and they got glandular fever, and so they were quite happy to be away from school for a while. Now what we find in their adulthood is that they're sick again because there's a lot of marital problems going on. So what we see when we go through that patient's biography is that each time there are quarrels, then that patient suffers. So what I begin to understand immediately by doing the biography and looking at it from an unprejudiced, generalized way, is that fighting, verbal arguments do not serve this person well at all, and as a result of that, they are very sensitive to it, and they will react very negatively to it. And if it continues for a long period of time, it will drain their energy and they'll get sick. So what I will do then is that in the same way as what I'll do with the physicals, is that I will link all of these together, join it with the one rubric of quarrelsome. Not that I'm saying the patient is quarrelsome, but the quarrels and arguments as what is causing their problem, and just drag and drop, and that one rubric tells me the cause to the whole complaint. And that's how a big part of the HFA system works.
Okay, so I'm here. So even though they themselves may not be quarrelsome, or they may run or hide from people who are quarreling with them or instigating trouble like bullying, that rubric gets put into the mix for them because they're sensitive to it.
That's exactly right. And so what we're seeing now is that we're trying to generalize the cause and effect. It's about moving away slightly in our minds from either a medical model in the way that homeopathy used to be and is still practiced by a lot of the MDs, and away also from a psychological model. It's moving into an energetic model. Homeopathy is energy and nothing but energy. And so by understanding the laws of energy, then we can begin to understand how energy or what influences our patients, either for the positive and the negative. And one of the things that we know about energy is that there is an equal and there is an opposite. So we know that if there's an effect, the pathology, then we know that there's a cause. And Hahnemann was always big on cause. This is the whole reason why he went down the 12 years of trying to understand the miasms, because he always believed the prior cause should be in the makeup of the remedy. And so, too, I am following that lead. And so for every prescription of chronic disease, or at least non-infectious chronic disease that I treat, then what I am looking for is to follow Hahnemann's lead and look for the cause of it, the stress of it. And so in this particular case, we can tell because each time there was fighting in the house, that person responded with it becoming sick. Then I will put the quarrelsome, and if it's being criticised instead of quarrels, then I'd change the rubric from quarrelsome to censorious, or sometimes they're even both. And then they both get dragged and dropped into the box. Now I've got my cause, and now what I do is that I look for the generalised effect. The two together will give me the remedy. I do the facial analysis to make sure that the energy is going to be suitable, and that's the remedy that I give.
Well, this is really, again, very, very helpful for both beginners and advanced homeopaths to always review and reaffirm the way that you take a case. And as you said, you went to India speaking to professional homeopaths, and they still asked you, how do you condense the way that you take these generals into a simple themes and find what rubrics to do in a few minutes instead of a few hours of work. So we're just about done for today's show, and I've requested that the folks in the chat room, we have a lot of listeners today, let you know how much they appreciate that you have spent your time here with us on Homeopathy World Community Radio, Blog Talk Radio, and that we will see you next week, Monday at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, and also that we have more shows coming up Wednesday morning. Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim from India is going to continue on talking about heart infections. And on Thursday at 1 p.m. will be Dr. Christina Chambreau, veterinarian homeopath. We're going to talk about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder in pets, And on Friday at noon, we're going to have Alan Phillips talking about vaccinations, current events about vaccinations and your rights, and that people should have freedom to make health choices. So again, I want to thank you, and I'm going to end the show. Please, folks, if you have questions, send them directly to us, and we will address them on later shows. Okay.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy and Spatial Analysis on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopaths Debbie Bruck and Grant Bentley. We encourage you to follow our show. Click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air. Share with friends on Facebook and MySpace, and also Twitter. We welcome your comments and questions. See you next time.